and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. We have had some incredible leaders from the corporate world and the coaching world on this podcast, but we've never had a leader from a military background join us on the podcast, and that is about to change today. We are joined today by Mike Bates. Mike is a human intelligence specialist and former covert counter-terrorism operations leader. Mike was born and raised in Doncaster, and he carved out a career that most boys would dream of, spending years undercover as a human intelligence specialist and counter-terrorism operations leader and commando in the Royal Marines. Mike was a real-life James Bond, but all of those years undercover, Mike didn't know who he really was, until he undertook the biggest challenge of his life, becoming the fastest British person to complete the world's toughest row solo, that's rowing across the entire Atlantic Ocean solo, in little over 46 days. This is an incredible conversation about leadership. We break up this conversation into four chunks to reflect the four different stages of Mike's life. We talk about how leadership is first imprinted on us when we are children, and what we take into adulthood about our view of leadership based on our early years experiences. We talk about what it's like to be led into war by two very different types of leaders in Mike's Royal Marines career. We talk about working undercover in counter-terrorism and Mike becoming an agent runner, and what it really takes to find common ground to be able to lead people to do good. And we also talk about this while balancing the ever-changing family dynamic. Mike's a father of two boys. And this story really does provide a powerful and credible perspective on resilience, leadership, humility, and overcoming adversity. Enjoy the conversation. Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we are joined by Mike Bates. I'm just going to hand over to Mike and let you introduce yourself in a few words. Go on. Who are you? What do you do?
Well, the challenge there is a few words, I think, for me, as you well, you know me well enough, Rach, so I'll try and keep it succinct. Well, who am I? What have I been doing? Well, I'm a former commando, so I served my country for 20 years, first as a Royal Marine, and then in the covert space where I was a covert operations leader, specifically in the agent running and undercover world. So working with people, I would say, is my speciality. And went on to row an ocean solo most recently. I was from a loving but broken family. And I think my most greatest achievement is my family. And so beneath all that, you know, I'm so proud to be a husband and a dad. And is that short enough for you, Rach? How's that work?
Yeah, I love that. Thank you, Mike. Well, welcome to the podcast. And let's start with your story. What we're going to do today is follow your story, and then we'll ask you about how your view of leadership has changed throughout that story. So you're a Donny lad like me, Donny girl. So take us back to growing up in Doncaster. Bit about your schooling, your background. You talked about broken home, loving but broken home. What was early Mike like?
Early Mike was a happy Mike. I was the eldest of three kids. Dad was a plumber. Mum stayed at home looking after us three. And I always say it was a very normal upbringing up until the age of 10. And obviously at the time you don't realise this, but having reflected on it deeply, as you have to do in the undercover world, you have to know yourself really well. I know that now to be the pivotal moment of my life where everything kind of changed. My dad left and I was left almost in a leadership position, I would say, at 10 years old, navigating two warring factions, negotiating, protecting my younger brother and sister, trying to have empathy there, but also struggling myself. And I was having therapy aged 11 at a place called Cheswold House in Doncaster, which is attached to the hospital where I was born. And I used to tell my friends, because of my shame associated with having therapy, well, no one called it therapy then, it was counselling. Yeah. I used to tell them I was going to an asthma clinic, which I was equally ashamed about, but it sounded better than going into counselling. And I think my mum was really worried about me. I'd become increasingly violent. I was smoking weed every night aged 13. I was drinking at 14. I was arrested at 15 and locked up for the night. And life wasn't looking that rosy for me. And then I was running pubs and I met a guy who'd been in the Navy. And I was 19 at the time. And he said, Mike, you know, if you're going to And I think, again, upon reflection, this is the wonderful thing about time and age and experience, isn't it? You get to truly understand what you were going through back then. I was looking for, and I didn't realize at the time, I was looking for connection. I was looking for a brotherhood. I was looking for something larger than myself. And that feeling, as we'll probably unpick later with the agents that I ran, was the feeling that the majority of them were looking for as well. And I felt a sense that I wanted to join the military. And no one had ever done that in my family. My uncle bet me 50 quid. I would never do it, based on the fact that my first run was a mile long and I had to stop halfway around. But I did it. I joined the commandos age 20. And fortunately enough for me, I joined and I was in training when 9/11 happened. And so I had more medals on my chest than my sergeant major had after 3 years, because we were Afghanistan, Iraq, Northern Ireland. And so a phenomenal arena to see leadership in its true form and in its greatest form, but also at its worst, I would suggest. And we'll come on to that stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah. Just on that then, before you go into the Royal Marines, tell us about a leadership position at 10. And kids are in that, aren't they, when they're the soothers of the parents, and you kind of learn about what not to do in leadership, but also you get it wrong at that age because you're not equipped for it. You've not got the experience. So 19-year-old Mike, what was his behaviour like? What was your view of leadership? And was your dad any kind of role model at that age?
No, I mean, unfortunately, I still don't have a relationship with my dad. I say unfortunately because I think deep down, if I'm really honest, I would love to relationship with my father, but it's just he lives 40 minutes away and we don't see each other, unfortunately. I think thinking about that and just in the time we've been talking already, what springs to my mind is a lack of leadership. And I think all children, particularly young boys, need really positive male role models in their life. I didn't have one in my father. I didn't have that rudder, that kind of North Star. I didn't have anyone to say, you're on the right track, or guess what? You know, smoking weed every night isn't a good idea. In fact, the only time, and this is not me to slag my dad off, by the way, but the only time he's ever said he's proud of me was after the ocean run when I was 42, and when he sent me a text message. So I think we're going to talk about leadership. I think a lack of leadership actually is a really thing to think about. And I was thrust into that. I think what I thought leadership was, or what served me the best then, was to shout the loudest and to punch the hardest and to try and exert myself and be someone that on the outside I felt everyone needed to see, but because I'm strong and this isn't affecting me. But on the inside, I was the complete opposite.
Yeah, what was it in that chap that you worked with that was in the Navy that really like struck a chord with you?
I think it was that he only spoke about his time in the Navy as in terms of a sense of adventure. And I think coming from Doncaster, as you know, Rach, it's a pretty quiet town. And not many people, in fact, everyone that I grew up with stayed in Doncaster and probably still there right now. I don't see any of them. I remember I was the only one to leave. We went back for a funeral of a friend of ours who died early and when I was 20. And I was the only person who left the town. They were all still in the same pubs, doing the same jobs. And that's great, you know. But so I think he was telling me about a wider world and a sense of opportunity. And for me, that just really was something I wanted to experience.
Mike, you were the eldest of three. Are you in touch with your siblings? And have you had a conversation with them about how they saw you as a 10-year-old?
I haven't had a conversation about how they saw me. I could hazard a guess. I think one thing we have spoken about, or I'm certainly very mindful of, is the impact of that divorce having a very different impact on each of us, depending on who we were within that kind of hierarchy is the one word, but, you know, in terms of the eldest, the middle. And so, for instance, me, I was sat at the top of the stairs, hearing my mum crying, hearing the door slamming, going downstairs, put my arm around her and being that person my dad should have been. So I don't mind a bit of conflict. You know, I'm used to it. My brother, 2 years younger, would hide his head under the covers and put his fingers in his ears. Mm. And he hates conflict, and he always has. And my sister, 2 years younger than him, didn't really get what was going on. So has always been scratching to try and keep hold of all the relationships in her life. So I think it affects us all in different ways, something like that, doesn't it? But I think if they were to describe me back then, I think they'd probably say angry, alone. They had a much closer relationship between the two of them than I had. I felt like a bit of a black sheep. But I think as we've moved through our lives, I think they say they're proud of me as well, because I have had the courage to break out, I suppose, and do something on my own.
Yeah, I mean, they are very valid feelings, aren't they? And nobody could expect anything else sometimes in those situations. I think there are a lot of kids who go through divorces and actually at the time don't really know what the impact of that is until later on in life. Did you feel that was the same for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I hadn't reflected on this stuff until, in order to be an undercover officer in the organization that I worked for, it was because you were going up against the highest risk terrorists in the UK, you have to know yourself well. You have to know yourself well if you're going to know how you need to insert yourself into someone else's life. And so we used to get psychologically assessed on a regular basis. And actually one of the psychologists who was working with me, he did say, like, out of everyone he'd worked with in that sphere, I don't think he's met anybody who knew themselves as well as I did. But I spent a long time thinking about what had gone on when I was a child. And I understood the impact it had on me. I think even as a young man as well, like 18, on my 18th birthday, I bought my mum a bunch of flowers to say sorry, because I knew I'd treated her awfully, really, for many years. And it was just out of hurt, right? Like, I didn't know how to handle it. You don't when you're that age. You think you do.
But that's not the intention, is it? It was never the intention. It's just how it happens. Just for the sake of our listeners, I am guessing that the reason that you need to know yourself very well when you're in that sphere is your ability to hold it together if you're getting interrogated.
Yeah, and also your ability to understand others, because if you know yourself well, you know, the art of running agents, the art of working undercover is to find common ground, right? You're trying to insert yourself into someone's life when they probably have an opposite opinion of what life should look like. But you can always find common ground, whether that's an upbringing, whether that's a sibling, whether that's a football team, whatever it is, there's always something between humans, no matter from what walk of life they come from. There's always something. So if you know yourself well enough, you know what matters to you, you've got a better chance of trying to find that in other people as well.
Fast forward a little bit then to the Royal Marines. So you join at a very tricky time. What happened then? What did you learn about leadership? What were your behaviours around that time in your life?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be sent to 4-5 Commando with a spearhead for the armed forces at the time. So we were the first British troops into Afghanistan in 2002. And I was even more fortunate that I was put into 3-Troop Whiskey Company. And the sergeant in that troop was a guy called Steph Moran. And Steph Moran, I saw him actually last year on a 20-year reunion from Afghanistan. He was revered as this legend in the Royal Marines, a hard Glaswegian who I only learned this last year, but was abused as a child. And in terms of, there was no better leader in my eyes at that time. He was a hero to me and a hero to 30 other young Marines in the early 20s. Someone who'd passed all of the most difficult courses, who led by his actions, never asked us to do anything that he wasn't prepared to do himself, deeply cared about the Marines that he took to war. And to sum Steph Moran up, he told me last September when I saw him after 20, I hadn't seen him in 20 years, that his greatest achievement, because he ascended to the rank of Regimental Sergeant Major in the Royal Marines in 4-5 Commando, which is a phenomenal achievement. And he said his greatest achievement of all was bringing all of his commando unit back from Afghanistan without losing one man.
It's when every other,
yeah, but and the way he did that was he'd built a level of credibility amongst the men that when he said to them, we're going out there on a hearts and minds mission, not a killing mission, they listened. And that's what they did. So he was someone, like I say, led by example. And I was just so fortunate to see that and to work with him day to day.
So you went to Afghanistan. Was it Northern Ireland next?
I was Iraq for the war the year after, where I saw a very different type of leadership. And again, the sergeant position within our section, you know, I'd been working with Steph Moran, who, as I say, and the thing was that Steph did, which I thought was remarkable, was he stuck up for us. He was that buffer between the officers and us, and he backed us. Even if we got it wrong, even if we made a mistake, he'd stand in the middle and say, well, I'm going to take this responsibility on because they're my lads. the night before we went to Iraq for the war, I was actually in Jordan at the time, getting ready to cross the border. We were supporting special forces. And a Hercules aircraft came in with a load of supplies. Bearing in mind, within about 3 hours, we were going to war. Within that 3 hours, all you want to do is rest. You want to rest, you want to collect your thoughts. Now, we unfortunately had a sergeant at that time who was desperate for promotion. And so he volunteered us all 3 hours before war to go and unload this aircraft because it made him look good to his commanding officer. And the contrast between the two inhabiting the same position of leadership and the same authority couldn't have been more stark. And I always remember that. There's someone who's in it for themselves. Steph Moran was in it for us. And I think, thankfully, the world worked its magic and Steph rose to the highest rank that you can rise as a non-commissioned officer. And I think hopefully that's what happens to the good people.
Yeah, it's interesting though, isn't it, that you remember that story about unloading that truck so viscerally 20 years later. Just the stark contrast, isn't it? That's what we talk about all the time about leadership shadow, don't we, John, and reputation and these things. Yeah. They make lasting impressions.
I mean, we knew at the time that individual was asking us to do that for his own gains. And I think that's why it sticks with you. You know, we were saying as we were unloading the aircraft, you know, and we're talking here like tons and tons of kit. Like we literally unloaded it, turned around, put our gear on and went to war. And we should have been relaxed at that point. We should have been, you know, might not be coming back. So we should have been just chilling out. And I think it's the fact that we knew that leader wasn't in it for us was the thing that stuck with us.
And what was that experience like of going into war with him?
We didn't rely on him, to be fair. I think at that point, your credibility is eroded to a degree where if you set, in my opinion anyway, particularly when the stakes are so high and lives are on the line, if you don't trust someone, you don't follow them. They can try and lead all they want, but you just do your own thing because you have no trust in that individual at all. Steph Moran on the other side, I'd have died for that man. You know, we did. You know, we jumped into the most mined country in the world following him. And wherever he went, we would have gone. The other individual, if he'd have gone right, maybe he'd have gone left.
Yeah. Having experienced the sort of leadership with Steph then and the unloading of that aircraft 3 hours before you're sent off to war, what did you think about in terms of him doing that? And did that actually in the first place allow you to think, well, we aren't going to trust this guy? And so almost he'd done you a favor. He'd done that before you got involved in it.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about the decision that sergeant in Iraq had made whilst we were unloading the aircraft. You know, we were unpicking his decision. It was clear. You know, people aren't stupid, right? Whether this is a business organization, this is, you know, the military or anything in between, people, they see actions, right? And they know. They know if the sentiment matches those actions and they know if it's disingenuous as well. And there's nothing you're going to say as a leader that's going to have any impact compared to your actions. So we were already unpicking that as we were pulling the water and the food off this aircraft for other people, by the way, who weren't going to war. And so I think that decision was made within an instant.
You say same old, it's the old adage, isn't it? That, you know, people often don't remember what people said, but the damn well remember what they did. They remember the actions. Yeah.
Absolutely true.
So you come back from that next tour. What's next for you in the Royal Marines? And lead that story on to what was the fundamental shift in you, you know, from joining at 20 to when you left?
So I should say, when I was in training in the Royal Marines, 60 men started in our troop, only 9 finished the commando course. But I was plucked out after 2 weeks, me and 2 others, and given some orange tapes to wear. And we were given like a leadership position within that recruit troop. Not because we knew what the hell we were doing, but because the Royal Marines had seen something within us, I think, that they thought had potential. After Afghanistan, I was promoted to Lance Corporal. I'd only done 11 months when I went to Iraq. I was commanding 8 men to war after 11 months of experience. And within that section, I had a guy who'd done 15 years, a guy who'd done 8, and a guy who'd done 4. And the reaction to me being promoted and becoming their section commander wasn't pleasant to start with. But by the end of Iraq, I'd like to say, certainly in Northern Ireland, they were you know, my loyalist supporters, because again, I led through my actions. And I think that all I was doing was being the best soldier I could be. I was doing my job as well as I could possibly do. And I cared deeply about my men. And basically, I was just living the Steph Moran mold. His influence is so profound. And I think as leaders, we, particularly when we're learning to lead, we need people that we can follow. So not Northern Ireland the following year, so 3 years, 3 6-month tours. I was now second in command within that section. I had 25 men to look after with the commanding officer. And that's unheard of really in a military space. You know, you don't command that amount of men after 2 or 3 years. But whatever I was doing, I didn't know what it was at the time, but whatever I was doing was working and I was showing natural leadership to the point where the Royal Marines invited me to become an officer, which I politely declined because once through Limston Commando is enough. No one wants to go and get the Green Beret twice.
So if anyone's listening to this then, Mike, who might want to follow your lead, if you like, 19, 20-year-old, what advice would you give your 19, 20-year-old self, having come through all that, and what the pointers that somebody should be mindful of if they're going to attempt to follow this kind of career?
I think you need to, you know, authenticity is a word that is bandied about a lot of the moment, but I think it's absolutely true. You've got to be yourself, right? Now, I wasn't at that point as a 20, 21-year-old, 22-year-old guy. I didn't have a clue about leadership. No courses. You just thrust into it. Take these 8 men to war and let's try not get killed, you know. There was no books that I was reading. There was no self-development. I was just being me. So I think being yourself and not trying to be someone else is the key to being a really, really authentic leader. And I think those people stand out, don't they? Certainly in my estimation. I think Steph Moran was being himself. I won't name the other person, but that guy was trying to be someone else for someone else. And that you see straight through it, man. So yeah. I think the advice to any young person is, one, you're never young enough to lead. You're never too young to lead, sorry. Experience counts for nothing, in my opinion, in leadership. I often say that we should be leading at all levels. So, you know, start by leading yourself and then just be yourself. The rest will happen.
Yeah, yeah. So what made you leave the Royal Marines? What made you venture onto what's next?
Well, luckily for me, I got pneumonia and pleurisy, which not many people would say, but it put me back into Doncaster Royal Infirmary for 10 days, the place I was born, the place I was getting care. I couldn't escape that place. And it gave me, why I'm grateful is it gave me about 2 weeks to just step off the treadmill of life and just say, you know what, where am I heading here? The Royal Marines want me to go and become an officer and lead men more broadly. Special Forces, I was heading down that pathway. I knew I loved serving my country. That was a passion of mine. I loved operational work. But I knew that my biggest ambition in life would be to have a family.
What age were you at this point? 25. And you were already thinking about having a family. Had you met your wife at this point?
No, I hadn't. I think I grew up quite fast. I mean, anyone who goes to war 3 times in 3 years, you know, you grow up pretty quick. So I kind of knew what I wanted at that point. And so I applied for a job which I'd seen advertised but didn't really think it existed. That was within the intelligence and security fields of the MOD. We'll call it that. I'm not allowed to say exactly who I worked for. I'm still bound by the Official Secrets Act for life. And thankfully, I got the job. It was a long process. And you have to give a year's notice to leave the military. But because I was moving into this specific specialist area of work, they got me out after 6 months. And ironically, I said I was in training for the Royal Marines when 9/11 happened. I was in training for this job when 7/7 happened. I was on the tube that morning, went into work, and none of the training team turned up because they were all following terrorists around in Leeds. So again, started my intelligence career at the busiest period of time the UK had ever seen. And again, saw leadership in a very different way.
What can you share about your career undercover in this agency, shall we call it? And what can you share about your experiences, your feelings, your observations of the human psyche whilst working undercover and being an agent runner? What can you share about that period of your life that's relevant to leadership?
You won't be surprised to say that I can't share much around the operational work.
But the feelings and the observations and the learnings, what can you share on that?
Absolutely. Well, I think I've already talked about one of them, that, you know, finding common ground between individuals, no matter what those two people believe, or, you know, they can believe the absolute opposite, and you can still find common ground, and you can still work with people. I think you've got to role model behaviors. I think you've got to understand motivation deeply. You know, when you're thinking about recruiting an agent, motivation is your key question. You know, some people want money. Some people, you couldn't stuff enough money down the throat, they still won't take it. That, you know, they're in it for ideological reasons. They're in it for the good. So it's understanding people and their motivation first and foremost. I'd say actually on that, and this is one, I suppose, to consider for leadership in business, money, in my experience, tends to be the least motivating factor. I think we automatically go to pay rises and bonuses, but actually that's not the thing that people work the hardest for, in my experience. And I was asking people to put their lives on the line, right? They don't want the money. They want a sense of achievement. They want a sense of camaraderie. They want a sense that they're having an impact on the world with other people, and that they're leaving a mark on the world. I think that's what people really want. That was my first kind of observations, really, of running agents. Well, forget the surveillance years, because you're just following the back of someone's head. So there's no leadership going on there. But certainly when it comes to working with people, it's about understanding the person that you sat across the table from. If we don't do that, then we're probably going to miss each other somewhere. And if we do that, we've missed an opportunity. And you can't miss opportunities when you're running agents. So what we would do, and I'd say an analogy for this is an appraisal meeting between a leader, perhaps one of the senior team, is to spend some real time thinking about what you want out of that meeting before you step through the door. You know, I think just wandering in there with no real clear sense of what it is you want from that meeting or from you or from them is a big mistake. If you do that in the world of agent running, you don't recruit the agent. If you don't recruit the agent, you don't find out about the terrorist. If you don't find out about the terrorist, a bomb goes off. So I used to spend a lot of time truly trying to understand not just the superficial of the individual, but inside. I think great leaders do that. I think they know their people well. I think they know what makes them tick. They know what they want. They know what motivates them. And they're in it to try and help. And I'll just finish on this, Ray. Sorry, that the one thing that I used to say to any agent that I recruited, and I would say again, and I can see this, and it's the way I do it in my own business now. I used to say to them, look, no matter how long this relationship lasts, whether this is 2 weeks, 2 years, 20 years, I guarantee your life will be in a better place at the end of it. And I think that transaction of I'm in it to help you and I know you're here to help me is the key.
Just it's okay if you can't answer this, but question for you. Think about the best agent you ever recruited and the one that got away, the one that you still, if there is one that you think you really tried but you just weren't able to recruit them and maybe something catastrophic happened as a result. Reflecting on those two experiences, is there any insight there or anything about leadership or anything about the human psyche that you reflect on now with regards to leadership and how you evolved over that period?
About my evolution, I think the answer I'll give you is a combination of the two. The best agent I ever recruited was someone who'd already told the organization that I worked for to, excuse my French, fuck off. So, and the reason that happened was, and if they'd recruited him in the first instance, I think we'd have been a lot further on. But that person, that agent runner, did not think deeply about who this person was. They went in with, might I say, some arrogance. I am so-and-so and you will listen and you do. And we've seen leaders like this, haven't we? You know, dictators, directors, you know, they're not in it for the greater good. I think when I went back to that individual 3 years later, I'd spent months thinking deeply about who he truly was and why did he want to join ISIS? Why did his friends join ISIS? And why didn't he go? And I felt I understood him. So when I stood in front of him, I wasn't stood in front of him in a pinstripe suit. I was stood in front of him in a hoodie and jeans because the guy wore hoodies and jeans. You know, I didn't turn up in, you know, a clapped out Volvo. I turned up in a Range Rover because I knew he liked nice cars. I didn't take any cops with me because he hated cops. And I created a persona that myself didn't really like police officers. I do like police officers, but for that operation, I didn't. So I think it's really comes down to that, Rach. I can't put it any more succinct than this. You've got to understand the people that you're trying to lead.
But that means you have to understand yourself first is the message I'm massively getting, Mike. Yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah. Dare we ask, as a leader, did you meet your wife whilst you were working undercover or whilst you were in this period? Like, in what context and what came next after that?
Yeah, I definitely didn't meet her working undercover. Many a Met police officer have been blooming sent to jail for that. No, I did meet her while I was working in that organisation, yes. Yeah. So, I met her in 2007 and... thankfully for me, my wife's one of the most grounded and humble individuals in the world. We saw that with the Ocean Rowing, how she supported me on that. I thought she'd find it quite cool that she was going out with a guy who ran agents, but she's not interested. I remember telling her one night, I thought it was the coolest thing ever, and she was like, oh, I'm not interested, put the kettle on. And that was lovely. so yeah, met in 2007, and we had two children very shortly after, and I was navigating living a double life whilst being a dad and a husband as well, which is not easy.
No, I can imagine. And there are the odd parallels, aren't there? I mean, John and I work with a lot of senior leaders and CEOs who you probably saw your children more living the life undercover than what other people with very senior positions have. But I think whatever your role is, that it becomes very difficult when you have children because you want to provide and you want to earn, which takes you away from them. We get this crossroads, don't we, where you often end up foregoing spending time with them thinking that they need the money and actually they need your time. And as such, that's one of the big things to think about when you're juggling that. And I imagine for you, it was just very different. The periods of time were probably longer, but the quality of time was probably different when you did spend time with them.
Yeah, I think what people sometimes mistake the world that I was in intelligence as being a bit like the military. You go away for 6 months. I was home every night. You know, I was, you know, following a terrorist around or chatting to terrorists like at 2 o'clock and picking the kids up at 3:30. I mean, I forgoed promotion and passed up opportunities to make sure I was at home.
Yeah,
you know, I knew that I wanted to be the best dad I could possibly be. And if I wanted to ascend the corporate ladder, I need to be in London. Well, I spent 3/4 of my career outside of London, where I could be at home every night with my children. I could walk them to school and hold their hands. And for me, you know, I always say the greatest lesson my dad ever taught me was how to not be a good dad. So I made sure that I did that. But it is tricky, and occasionally you have to go away. I was posted to Canada for a year. I mean, the family came after 5 weeks and we spent a year out in Canada, which was amazing. But yeah, it isn't easy. I think everything you do in life has a cost, right? And you've got to understand that. Like, if you want to build a phenomenally successful business or you want to lead 500 people, there's going to be a cost associated to that. And it's going to be in another space of your life, probably home, maybe yourself, maybe others. You can't have it all. And I was always aware of that. So, but I purposefully passed up many opportunities within my professional career to be at home with my family, because I know that's ultimately what I want out of life. I think the one thing that we'll all have in common, and I think this goes for any parent, particularly a parent who perhaps is a leader at work and spends a lot of time at work, is parent guilt. And I remember, you know, I was so desperate to be a good parent and so desperate for that hour before school to be amazing. If I had to tell them off, which I just did, because sometimes your military life doesn't leave you that easily, perhaps my patience wasn't what it should have been. I was in tears on the way to work. You know, and I couldn't wait for 3 o'clock to see him again. I was desperate.
And they don't remember. They don't remember.
They're not even bothered. They're not even bothered. They're messing around in the playground. But for me, I mean, that's my insecurity, right? That's, you know, the people I look to for my greatest relationships, my parents, well, certainly weren't left, right? So that's left me quite insecure inside. And so if I ever had to tell my kids off or whatever, I'd feel awful about it, because I think deep down I was worried they'd leave. Certainly my wife, she'll tell you as well, terrible at conflict, because in the aftermath of it, I'm always desperate to get back together in case they run off somewhere else.
And she just needs 10 minutes without you.
She needs more than 10 minutes without me, if you have to go, I reckon.
How did you balance the work that you were in and you know, particularly the danger that that you might be in, but also thinking about your family and how they may become implicated some way because of the work that you do.
Yeah. I mean, that would never happen if you're doing your job properly, because there's certain protocols you would always follow before and after work to ensure that no one followed you from the office to home. You know, and I was diligent in doing that work. I think people cut corners because you don't want to be doing anti-surveillance on your way home. But, you know, if you want to keep your family safe, I mean, obviously, you know, I've got a book coming out next year, and the organization I worked for, their first point to me was that you're putting everyone at risk, because I want to do it in my own name. I mean, at the moment, I feel like that risk benefit stacks up for me. I don't think there's a credible personal risk to me. I think there's bigger targets out there. I don't want to prove wrong, by the way, but I think we've seen, if you're a terrorist and you wanted a spectacular attack, coming after someone who resigned 3 years ago probably isn't as spectacular as an MP or a serving police officer or a military personnel.
Yeah.
So I kind of rationalize it that way. But at the time, they were never in. I mean, they didn't even know. I mean, my kids didn't know. Again, told them over the kitchen table the night I resigned, thinking I'd be the coolest dad in the world, like Alex Ryder or James Bond. And they just said, "Dad, pass the ketchup. What are you on about? Still embarrassing." So no matter what I do, they think I'm the most embarrassing person in the world. Teachers are pulling out papers with me on the ocean, and they're like, "God, just I've had enough of this guy."
Guess that's better than them of going like, "Well, we knew anyway, Dad."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly.
That leads us nicely though to the ocean. So you leave the agency, and you decide to not just go on a row, but like the world's toughest ocean row. What on earth were you thinking?
I was thinking that the unit that saved my son's life deserves better. And so my youngest boy was born 9 weeks prem in Leeds General Infirmary. He was on life support for about 6 to 8 weeks, ventilated. And then thankfully for my wife's spider senses, she had a mum's instinct after we'd had him home for a couple of weeks. He wasn't quite right. He had meningitis. I went off to follow a terrorist around in Manchester. I got rushing back, and the consultant said that if we hadn't brought him in, that they'd have been dead tomorrow. So I realised at that time in PICU that, you know, the NHS don't fund specialist equipment, charities do. And so I raised, you know, £2,000 or £3,000 straight after. But the trauma of, for anyone who's listening who's had a poorly baby, the trauma of it sticks with you, and it's like a locked box inside. And every birthday, on Gabe's birthday, I would get distraught, like overwhelmingly sad and upset. And it was just the trauma of it coming out. And I just felt this urge to want to repay that debt. You know, I was so grateful that we'd got him, and we met families in there who didn't take the children's home, right? Children home. So the row was a vehicle. It was never, I just thought, what's the most ridiculous thing a human can do? Like, I need to raise the most amount of money possible.
Mm.
You know, Leeds 10K ain't going to cut it. You know, I wanted to raise 70,000 quid for the hospital. We ended up raising over 135,000 for the hospital, over 170 total raised.
It's amazing. But had really you rowed before? Like, where did... Rage, I know it's a Rage, ridiculous thing.
I'm 5'8", right? You've met me. It's
no, a loaded question. This is the thing. I'm like, where... I totally love the wanting to give back. And I think what you've really connected there is the trauma. I had a very difficult birth with Felix, had PTSD after, and I feel very funny around his birthday, you know, constantly reminded of he wasn't meant to be here. But I hadn't actually thought about that will probably, you know, probably erupt, won't it, every year. It has done, certainly in hindsight. I've had quite a bit of counselling for it. Well, yeah, I've met you. I'm like, did you row in the military? There's no story here. Like, where does this... I'm going to get in a boat and row across the Atlantic solo come from?
Well, I think I saw a quote that said more people climb Mount Everest every year than have ever rowed an ocean solo. So I thought, well, okay, Everest is pretty tough, but rowing an ocean solo is pretty tough. There's less than 100 people ever rowed the Atlantic solo. And also, I think I've always been the kind of person who likes to set long-term challenging goals. So, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I'm a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, that takes 10 years, you know, of training every single week, competing, fighting, getting banged up. You know, it takes a long time. So the ocean road, the thing that intrigued me personally was that it was going to be a 3 to 4 year process. It wasn't something I could just lace some trainers up and go and start running. I had to learn, I had to get a boat. These are expensive pieces of kit. So I had to get a sponsorship. I had to do this in lockdown, which was really, really challenging. Businesses weren't even open. I had to learn the technical aspects of being on the water. I had to be fit enough to endure an ocean row on my own, rowing 17 hours a day for 46 days. So that kind of intrigued me a little bit. But really, it was about going, pitching up to sponsors and saying, look, I'm going to go do this. And there's a look they give you, which is like, and I've had the similar look when I finished, it's like shock and awe. They're looking at you and they can't quite join the dots. They're like, well, you're stood there, but no one can row an ocean on their own. And they can't quite put, and that little gap is the thing that says, go on then, I'll back you. And so what I made sure I did in lockdown was I posted every workout I did, worked out every day, never missed one rep in the gym. I can say that my preparation was flawless, but it was all about, it was just a vehicle to raise money. That was all it was.
Yeah. I think what we're seeing though, linking this back to the leadership that's a consistent in your life is the preparation, the incremental gains, the self-discipline is, I think you're the most self-disciplined person I've ever met in my life. Like, it's flawless almost to account that you are, you know, you are flawed, like by your own admission, but you keep doing the work consistently. And there's not many people that can do that over a year, let alone 3 or 4. And that's probably why you were where you were at 25, when most people only get there at 35 in the Royal Marines, et cetera, et cetera. Does that make sense? Would you agree with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, totally, yeah. I mean, two things I always talk about is movement creates opportunity. So you've got to be constantly moving forward. You should be setting goal after goal after goal. And this isn't like a dopamine hit. This isn't, I'll get a goal and then I'll be happy. Or that, this is just a self-transformation. You smoothing out the edges and making yourself this really well-rounded individual. So that's the first thing. And the other thing I would say is, like, what's the alternative? What do you want to be recognized for at the end of life? If you start there running a business and it's worth a load of money and you're not seeing your kids, no one's going to say that about you in the church. They're not going to say that. You know, so having that kind of like really strong purpose that I knew I wanted to make a mark on the world, not for me, but for others. Like I always say, I mean, the people helping business. I always have been. I served my country for 20 years. I've raised loads of money for charity. I'm building businesses to help other people. Like, of course, there's an element of ego in it. You know, of course there is. But the vast majority of what I do is for other people, man. It's to make a little bit of a mark on the world. Why wouldn't you want to do that? You're only here for 80 years. Get it done.
Just on the ocean row, I mean, it's probably a whole other podcast on itself around the grueling, the physical grueling, the emotional turmoil. What I'm very interested in is spending 46 days by yourself. You know, I think the max I've done is 3 days on a silent meditation retreat, but 46 days by yourself. What did you learn about yourself and about that is a phenomenal amount of time to lead yourself? Summarize that, if you wouldn't mind, in a minute. Like, what were your big takeouts from the ocean?
Human connection is everything. So without the connection between yourself as a human being and another human being, there is nothing. Forget financial success. Forget, you know, external success. It is the people that you love. And crucially for me, the learning was accepting love from other people, something I'm not very good at. If you're a striver, if you're someone who pushes and puts other people first, it's very difficult for you to accept help and also to accept the fact that people tell you that they love you. There was a moment on the ocean where I had one of my darkest days. I had three really dark days. And the third, the guy running my social media put a bit of a, I didn't know this was happening, asked for kind of people to send me comments, and he transcribed them all onto WhatsApp and sent me them. And when I put my satellite dish together and I read them, and it was, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how many people cared about me, because all I ever think about is caring about other people. So that was a real take home, that you've got to be open to receive that love as well. But the only thing that I thought about every single minute of every day was seeing the people that I loved again, seeing my family, seeing my wife, my children. No other motivation even came close The raising money at that point was insignificant. I never even contemplated. I never thought about it. It's my own survival was below this. You know, the last 3 days I rode for 22 hours straight. I mean, I rode 17 hours a day every day, but I rode 22 hours straight. And when every other person in the fleet went on to parachute anchor to stop their drift south, the safety officers rang me up. He said, "You need to go." I said, "I ain't doing it, man. My family's on the island. I can see it. Like, I ain't stopping until I get there." And no one thought I could get in. And I got in. And because the pull to see the people that I loved more than anything else in the world was just overwhelming. It's the kind of stories you hear, you know, when, you know, a mum picks a car up off a kid. You know, it's like you will do anything for the people that you love when you're really after.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a lovely note to end on. And it is closing tradition on our podcast that we ask our guests to share their three leadership essentials. I mean, I think this might be a struggle for you to only pick three, but we'll give it a go. But, you know, you've had a phenomenal life. You've had some extraordinary experiences like no one else in the world, I can imagine. But from all that phenomenal experience you've got, what would you impart to our listeners as your three leadership essentials?
Well, I've thought deeply about these, and I tried not to pick the obvious, you know, the values that I hold dear, like integrity. I tried to skip away from them. I think the three things that I would say, the three C's I'll call them. So courage, I think courage, and the way I would describe courage in leadership context is the courage to challenge the status quo, the courage to stand in front of that officer who says, go and unload the plane, and say, no, we're not doing it because the people I care about, the people I'm leading, don't need to do that right now. It's to do things differently. It's the courage to say no. It's the courage to admit that you were wrong. I think far too many leaders see that as a weakness. I think see it as a real strength. It's the courage to empower others to deliver and to give them not only the tools they need, but the autonomy to deliver in your kind of in your mission. So yeah, courage would be the first one. Second one would be clarity. And I would say a clarity of mission. I think you don't go into battle with any doubt about what the intention is because people will start shooting in the wrong direction. So the mission needs to be absolutely critical and everyone in your organization and as importantly, your customers, I believe, should know what your mission is and they will buy into that. Clarity of communication. Again, there should be absolutely no doubt on any communication, whether that's oral, written, or in any other form, about what you're trying to say to your staff. Clarity about the achievement that your staff have made. So praise when praise is due, that's key. We've got to do that as leaders. We've got to be telling people they're doing great. And clarity in the culture of the organization that you're trying to create. I think that's huge as well. And finally, seek for credibility. And what I don't mean by this is experience. That's the opposite of what I mean. What I mean is integrity, that you lead by your actions, and that you have care and empathy for other people and you inspire people to follow you on that mission. I think if you do those three things, you're not far off the mark.
Yeah, that it's an incredible story, Mike. Thank you for sharing. And there's some absolutely fabulous insight in those three leadership essentials that you shared. So thank you for putting some real thought into that. It's really appreciated. You are very, very interesting. You've mentioned, you've given us a little hint that you've got a book coming out next year. But in the meantime, if people are interested in perhaps getting you in to do a talk, I know you do talk on the corporate circuit, and I think you've got some events coming up. How can people get in touch with you and what's next for you?
What's next? Well, I tell you what is not next is another ocean road. I think everyone keeps saying, oh, you're going to go do the Pacific. I tell you the nicest thing just is that once you go out and prove to the world who you really are, prove to yourself who you really are, the pressure comes off, man. It's a lovely, peaceful place. So I'm not going to be doing any big adventures, but I do speak. If you want to get in touch, follow me on Instagram, MikeBates_official. Go to LinkedIn, Mike Bates, Facebook, Mike Bates, MikeBatesOfficial@gmail.com. I do have an agent who looks after my speaking, but you can contact me directly. We can work that out. And in terms of kind of future events, obviously a book's coming out, which is fantastic. Maybe some broadcast work. My big passion and the thing I did immediately when I resigned from the Ministry of Defence was to set up a thing called the Next 45, which is going to be a business aimed at helping men navigate midlife and to live the second half better than the first. And I think, again, hopefully with my experiences, we're able to help some people live their life without limits. If we do that, then my life's a success.
Wonderful. What we'll do is we'll put all those links in the show notes. So if anybody that's listening is really interested to find out more information, we'll make sure that they're all available in the show notes. But thank you so much. Best of luck whatever's next. Really looking forward to see what happens with the next 45. And thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure, guys. All the best.
Mike, thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, Google Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcast from, and give us a rating so other people can find this content.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.